From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics Claudia Puig, Amy Nicholson, and Peter Rayner have a full slate of new movies. It's a particularly big week for documentaries, including Leap of Faith, William Friedkin on The Exorcist. The director of the groundbreaking film goes deep in examining his approach to making what's considered one of the scariest horror movies of all time. The documentary Coded Bias looks at an MIT researcher's concerning findings on facial recognition algorithms. Writer-director Anish Chaganti's horror thriller Run stars Sarah Paulson and Kira Allen. Our critics also tell us their favorite holiday films. It's Film Week on KPCC.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I'm joined this week by film critics Peter Rayner of the Christian Science Monitor, Claudia Puig, president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association and senior programmer of our own AFI Film Festival in L.A., and Amy Nicholson, who's film writer for the New York Times and host of the podcasts Unspooled and Zoom. We begin with the documentary from Romania, Collective. It's directed by Alexander Nanau. Amy, tell us about Collective, please.
Gladly. You know, of all the silver linings of being a film lover this year, at least one of them is we're getting to start the top of the show with a Romanian documentary that is just terrific, terrific. I'll set the stage of what it's about really quickly. People might remember that in October of 2015, there was a giant fire at a nightclub in Romania, at a nightclub called Collective. So it became known as the Collective Fire. What happened is that at this concert, 27 young people died initially, but then nearly another 40 people died later in the hospital of infection. And so this is a documentary about a few things, about journalism, about the government responsibility, what we should respect, what we should expect from our government, and about how to figure out the truth when people don't want you to know. Because what happens is the journalists start by just trying to ask one question, like, why did the medical system fail these kids in a hospital? And the answer they get leads to the next question, leads to the next question, and it winds up exposing this entire scaffolding of corruption and bribes that kind of seems like it leads to the top. It's incredible to watch.
Collective, the documentary. Claudia.
I agree. That scaffolding that Amy mentions is so fascinating. It plays out like a thriller. This, by the way, is also Romania's official Oscar selection. First time they've ever put forth a documentary for that honor. It just really reminds us of the importance of investigative journalism, the watchdog function of the press. And it feels like a Pandora's box. It just leads the specifics of it. Just one thing leads to the next, and it's it is so disturbing, but it also is very rewarding in the sense that we see how journalism ought to function.
Collective, Peter.
Yeah, it's a really terrific movie. It's a true life newspaper investigative thriller. What's interesting also is that the investigation was led by a sports newspaper, the Budapest Sports Gazette. The lead reporter was a Catalan Tolantan, who is a remarkable reporter investigator. He grills the health minister. Ultimately, this all led to the resignation of the prime minister, and a new health official was put in place who has to deal with all of the stuff that came before, and it's among many other things, sort of a film about how an idealist tries to cope with the reality of the situation in a political arena. So it's quite remarkable on every level.
All right. We're talking about the documentary Collective. And, you know, it sounds like when you're talking about a documentary on corruption, that can get so complicated with so many moving parts very quickly. Amy, how is it that the filmmakers navigate through that and make it clear?
Yeah, they really navigate it just linearly, because the way that one question leads to the next, you see the journalists in the room, like they get one crazy piece of information and they say, well, what does this mean? And where do we go with this? And so they're really, you know, you're watching as they figure out the next step, and you're kind of hand in hand with them as they walk along. I mean, you're there on this granular level where you watch how they moderate even the violent comments they'll allow on their comment section. You're there as, you know, they figure it out. So it really feels like the audience is being brought along, and not you're doing kind of a postmortem of something incredibly complicated, which does get really unwieldy.
Collective, the documentary from Romania we're talking about, directed by Alexander Nanau. The film is unrated. Final thought from you, Claudia, about the film, and why, for someone who wouldn't necessarily care about corruption in another country, why as a film this is so compelling?
Well, it just, you know, it's one of those fly on the wall documentaries, so it really does play out like a thriller. The characters are interesting. There is a particular character who's brought in. There's the main journalist who is at the head of it all, Tolontan, and this is a sports gazette that you know, that he works for, and you know, he's fascinating. And then they bring in this wonderful survivor who is badly burned, but we see her story of recovery and activism. So there's a lot more going on, even in addition to the investigative press aspect.
Collective can be seen on Lemley's Virtual Cinema, as well as the on-demand platforms iTunes, Vudu, and Fandango. Now it's unrated. The horror thriller Run stars Sarah Paulson and Kira Allen. The film is directed and co-written by Anish Chaganti. Claudia, please start us on Run.
I love this film. I am a fan of Anish Chaganti and his co-writer and producer, Sev Ohanian and Natalie Kasabian. They did Searching, which was that thriller that came out a couple years ago. It was a Sundance hit. It had John Cho. And it was basically all done through screens, laptops, and phones. And it was really well done. And this shows that that was not just a one-off. This is a really perfectly paced, well-edited, nimbly acted thriller, and we have Sarah Paulson, who's always fantastic, and then a new actor, Kira Allen, who plays her 17-year-old daughter. And one of the great things about it is that she is the character is in a wheelchair, and the real actress is in a wheelchair. You know, we've certainly seen enough movies like Wait Until Dark or Rear Window, where people are, you know, in some way disabled, but they're played by abled actors. And this is one case in which they cast, Chaganti was wise enough to cast somebody who actually was, you know, differently abled and just does such an amazing job and focuses on her strength and her character, not so much her disabilities, but not her victimhood so much as her kind of fierce capability.
We're talking about the horror thriller Run, Amy.
Yeah, the setup here is it's kind of the Munchausen syndrome version of Misery. You know, you have a girl in a wheelchair trapped by her mother who seems to be very devoted to the idea of keeping her daughter under her thumb. And what I appreciate about it is that the daughter is very smart from the beginning. You know, this isn't like you're kind of yelling at her, like, figure out what's happening. You know that something is wrong. Like, you can tell from the beginning that she's aware something is off. You know, she's trying very hard to get to the mailbox before her mother does, for example, because it's even though her mother is insisting to everybody how thrilled she is she's going away to school, this daughter doesn't quite buy it. What I think that Anish Chaganti does really well in how he tells this story is he really emphasizes, you know, her brains and the how. You know, the scenes are really structured on, like, how is she going to get out of her room? Like, how is she going to figure out what this mystery pill is? And it's so small that it becomes thrilling. You're really right there with her as you're panicking. I mean, I will say, like, for Sarah Paulson, this is the kind of role she can do in her sleep. So you're like, okay, Sarah Paulson, you're doing your thing. But it's a fun watch.
Run is rated PG-13, and it's on the Hulu streaming service. The documentary Coded Bias takes us to the MIT Media Lab and researcher Joy Bulamwini and her media research of fallout from discovery about facial recognition algorithms. The film is directed by Shalini Kantaya. Peter, what'd you think of Coded Bias?
It's really good. It's a, you know, an eye-opener. Joy Bulamwini, who is a doctoral candidate at MIT, who I should also mention is an absolutely delightful personality who seems to own more glasses than Elton John, was doing facial recognition experiments using AI and noticed that the recognition didn't recognize her face particularly well at all. She put a white mask in front of her face, and suddenly the recognition was quite a bit better. And she realized that there's a whole gender race bias involved in facial recognition algorithms, and this led to a whole series of discoveries and revelations and connections with other researchers around the world, who have come up with similar stories. And it's really it points up the sort of homogeneous Silicon Valley programmers who are mostly white men who have been programming these algorithms. So you think that facial recognition software and so forth is neutral, but actually there's quite a bit of bias built into it, and that's what this film exposes and explores with Joy as kind of the point person.
Claudia, what do you think of Coded Bias?
Yeah, I agree 100%. It's really a wake-up call, and it's a call to action, for us to sort of put pressure on Silicon Valley and the creators of technology, to not have that bias, whether it's, institutionalized or and whether they're unaware of it. I think it's very thought-provoking. I saw this at Sundance, and this is one of the movies that has really stayed with me since Sundance. And as Peter pointed out, I think, through following Joy Bulamwini, we really get a sense of it. We also, what I love about how Shalini Kantaya makes this film is that she also it's very user-friendly. It's very, it's not
highly technical.
Talk. Yeah, exactly. It's just very, she goes to real people and we get a real sense of this, and you don't have to be, a techie to understand what's going on. And they also go to England and look at, the fact that in London, what's going on there. They go to they follow a group that does, that sort of watches the watchers, because it's a very kind of a high surveillance city in London. And so, we look at, okay. We see the whole global picture as well.
Coded Bias, the documentary, Amy.
Yeah, I mean, you're leaping all over in this documentary. You really get the sense that Shalini Kantaya is like, I have to get out everything I need to get out in here. You're talking about like an apartment in Brooklyn that has biometric scanning at the front door, which the residents hate. You're talking about the activists in Hong Kong who are spraying security cameras black. You're leaping everywhere. And if there is one kind of thing just at least to like walk away with that I think the documentary does hammer home, it's, this idea of what they're calling algorithmic oppression, which is a new word to me, but it is about how we really cannot trust what we consider to be neutral programming, that all of the innate biases that we have as humans, we've just put them into the algorithms for the machines that are just doing a new form of oppression that then affects people's credit scores. It affects who gets into college and who gets a scholarship. It affects your mortgages. It's now affecting teacher evaluations and prison sentences. We hear from people who are affected by both of those things. And you really walk away with a sense of, oh, this is just everywhere. And we have to stop and talk about it right now before it gets even more out of hand.
We're talking about the documentary Coded Bias on facial recognition algorithms, directed by Shalini Kantaya, and the film's unrated. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. Steve McQueen, the director, has a new anthology with 5 episodes, Small Axe is the anthology. Mangrove tells the story of the Mangrove Nine who clashed with London police in 1970. It stars Letitia Wright, Sean Parks, and Malachi Kirby, the film again, or the series, I should say, directed by Steve McQueen, who did 12 Years a Slave, among other films. And it's written by Alistair Siddons. Claudia, what did you think of Mangrove?
I like this a lot. Now that I've seen the very first film in this five-film saga, I can't wait to see the next ones. This one kicks off, it's largely a courtroom drama, although the scene is really set in this West Indian neighborhood in Notting Hill in 1970. So you really get a sense of the place. The time and place. The reggae music, it's set around this restaurant, which is called Mangrove. And you can almost smell the food. It's that rich in place and setting. And then, of course, it's an incredibly powerful and resonant and timely story about the institutional racism on the part of the police in London. And there's also a sense of hope that is imbued in it, which I really also appreciate. It's a love letter to West Indian life. And I also find it interesting that Letitia Wright, who was in Black Panther, plays a member of the Black Panthers in this too. And she's excellent in it. It's so well acted by everybody. It's just super, it's timely. There's no gaudy theatrics in the courtroom. It's intense and just really, really well directed, well edited. Everything about it is just top notch.
And it's streaming on Amazon Prime Video. We're talking about the five-part anthology series Small Axe and the initial episode Mangrove, directed by Steve McQueen, who does all of the episodes. Alistair Siddons is the writer. It's unrated, again, on Amazon Prime. We'll continue on Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back in just a moment.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
So good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson, Claudia Puig, and Peter Rayner. Next up is The Last Vermeer, starring Claes Bang and Vicky Creeps, Guy Pearce in the cast as well. Dan Friedkin makes his directing debut, the film written by Mark Fergus, John Orloff, and Hawk Ostby. Peter, what'd you think of The Last Vermeer?
Well, it's an interesting subject for a movie. I'm not sure it quite comes to life. It's based on a real character, Hans von Megeren, played by Guy Pearce, who this film takes place shortly after World War II, and he's suspected of having collaborated with the Nazis. He's a sort of a low-level artist who is possibly been, selling paintings to the Nazis, particularly Hermann Göring. There was a painting called Christ and the Adulteress by Vermeer, supposedly, and that's sort of at the center of the investigation by Claes Bang, who's had been in the military and now is an investigator. He's also Jewish, which seems to be somewhat of an incentive to get to the bottom of exactly how much of a collaborator von Megeren was. And there's a big trial that takes place in the near the end of the film that sort of resolves everything. It's an interesting concept, to sort of see is he a collaborator? What does collaboration mean? At one point von Megeren, gets on his high horse and says, that I believe every fascist deserves to be swindled. One of the problems I had is that it's a little too digressive. There's we don't need to know so much about the marital problems of Claes Bang's character and Guy Pearce. I assume he was told to do this, but he really overacts. And also the Vermeers, there are only about 30 Vermeers that we know of. He painted, you know, very few canvases, and they're all highly distinctive. And the central canvas that's under investigation here looks so unlike any Vermeer that you sort of have to wonder, you know, what were they thinking in even imagining that this was an original.
The Last Vermeers, the drama. Claudia, what'd you think?
Yeah, you know, it's an inherently fascinating and wild true story, Hans von Mingren's story, and I just felt like this was occasionally dull. It was sort of solid, but, you know, that doesn't reflect really what the story was about, and I agree, Guy Pearce was chewing the scenery, and then Vicky Cripps, who is so good in Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread, is given just kind of a throwaway role here. I thought Clay Spang was very good, but this vivid figure just deserves something a little bit more, I don't know, more enthralling and vivid, too. I feel like this was kind of solid at best and lackluster at worst.
Amy, what do you think of The Last Vermeer?
Yeah, it's all done in very, very large strokes. I mean, I do appreciate this time period and these questions of, like, how are we going to clean up this disaster that's just happened? Like, who are the collaborators? What do we have to do to get everybody back on the rails? That is a compelling framework for the story. But it's done in such strange, large strokes. I mean, my favorite thing about the movie is that how everyone in the film, when they meet this captain, Clay Spang, they just size him up and immediately in 30 seconds try to psychoanalyze his emotional wounds for some reason. It's like minute one, hello, nice to meet you. Didn't your dad love you? And you're like, what is happening? This movie is bizarre.
The Last Vermeer, based on Jonathan Lopez's book, starring Clay Spang, Vicky Cripps, and Guy Pearce. Dan Friedkin, the director, it's rated R at the Vineland Drive-In. Sound of Metal stars Riz Ahmed, Olivia Cooke, and Mathieu Amalric. The film's directed by Darius Marder, who co-wrote the screenplay with his brother Abraham Marder. Claudia, let's talk about Sound of Metal.
Yeah, this is a really, really, I like this movie a lot. And it's all anchored on the amazing performance of Riz Ahmed as this heavy metal drummer who loses his hearing and his life gets turned upside down. And he also has an addiction problem. So there's a lot going on here. Darius Marder co-wrote this screenplay with Derek Cianfrance, with whom he wrote The Place Beyond the Pines, which is also a film that I really loved. And Derek Cianfrance did Blue Valentine. So this has some of, you can definitely feel that moodiness from both of those films. But the thing that I love most about this movie is the use of the sound design. It has the best sound design that I've seen or heard in any movie this year. And I feel like sound design is kind of undervalued. You know, we focus so much more on cinematography, but we are so immersed in this as the lead character played by Riz Ahmed, his hearing deteriorates. We're put into his position. So we miss the sound of words. We, you know, things go silent. So they use sound in such an interesting way, in such a immersive way, so that we feel his disorientation and his pain. And Riz Ahmed, I think he's just such a great actor, whether it was in Nightcrawler or The Night Of. He's just, this is a real showcase for his acting.
Well, and people who do sound design are standing and applauding you, Claudia, for recognizing the talent that goes into it. Sound of Metal, Amy.
I'd love to hear that they're going to remix their applauding sound and make it sound even louder than it is. Riz Ahmed really is, I think, one of our most watchable talents right now. And this film, I think, leans heavily on it. Like, he's very convincing when he's drumming. He's very convincing at sign language. He's very convincing being frustrated. You know, this is a movie so much about denial. Like, can he get his life back just the way he had it? You know, and it's, to me, that was really relatable about it. You know, that struggle of, like, when your plans get dramatically changed, do you accept it? Do you fight back? And he chooses to fight back. And you can see why in here. He has this girlfriend in his musical life when he's a touring person, played by Olivia Cooke, who's just this amazing bohemian. And their van life is wonderful, and she's wonderful. And you get why he wants to go back there. But I appreciate that the film also really hammers home the point that, like, by rejecting the life that's now been put upon you, that's also an insult and a statement and it's not comfortable, and I don't know if you're making the right decision for yourself. So it's complicated, and it's complicated. I want to live this a little bit more than I did, but it's a really interesting cerebral watch.
Sound of Metal is rated R. It's at the Vineland Drive-In in Los Angeles County and on Amazon Prime Video for streaming. The documentary Leap of Faith, William Friedkin on The Exorcist, in which the director of that film talks about the filmmaking process. Amy, Leap of Faith.
Yeah, this is not your typical kind of talking heads doc fanboy film about a movie that you might love. Although if you are an Exorcist head, this will be really satisfying to watch. The documentary filmmaker here, Alexander Philippe, he does these deep spelunking documentaries. He did one into Alien last year. He did one into just the 3-minute shower scene of Psycho. But he is a person who's really curious about craft. And here he kind of pairs away even extra guest voices, and only talks to Friedkin about his choices and his decisions. And so it's really fascinating to kind of get inside Friedkin's head in this way. Like, he does all the talking alongside visuals. You know, when needed, Philippe will cut to Citizen Kane or to like a painting by Caravaggio to represent what he thinks that Friedkin is talking about. As a person who loves The Exorcist deeply and really enjoys so much of Friedkin's work, you know, it's interesting to hear him go back and kind of talk about how he made the decisions here with what he calls, you know, sleepwalking confidence. And there's a lot of stuff I didn't realize, that he deliberately chose a cameraman who had worked shooting documentaries about Fidel Castro in order to get this fresh one-take documentary feel to the film, which I don't think I was ever that consciously aware of. So I appreciate that this isn't like a sugary celebration, and maybe you have to be like a complete nerd for craft to love this, but I deeply loved it.
We're talking about director Alexander O. Philippe's documentary Leap of Faith, William Friedkin on The Exorcist. Claudia.
Yeah, I don't think I loved it quite as much as Amy. I do love The Exorcist. And I very rarely ever long for talking heads. But in this case, I feel like we could have used some, maybe just to escape being so much in Friedkin's head. I felt like I wanted to hear from Linda Blair. I realize you can't hear from Max von Sydow or Jason Miller, but who sadly passed on. But I don't know. I just felt like some of it felt like he wasn't the most reliable of narrators. He talks about how he's a one-take person, but then he sort of says other things that sort of belie that. Maybe that's part of what's intriguing about getting into his head. But, you know, I also feel like he's very intent on burnishing his legend, and certainly he is a wonderful filmmaker, but, you know, he talks about not being attracted to ambiguity, but then he talks about how many interpretations of The Exorcist there are. So I don't know. I understand what Philippe was doing, and I admire it, probably admire it more than enjoyed it.
Leap of Faith, William Friedkin on The Exorcist, unrated documentary, and it's on the horror streaming service Shudder. The biographical drama Last Call depicts the last days of the poet Dylan Thomas. Rhys Ifans and John Malkovich star Stephen Bernstein, the writer-director. Peter.
Well, this is a long slog through a very dark time at the end of Dylan Thomas's life, when he was, you know, downing a dozen plus whiskeys and then going on a tour, mostly of women's colleges, giving readings for money to support himself and a suffering wife and children back home in England. Rhys Ifans is a wonderful actor, and I have to say that, you know, when he's reciting Thomas's poetry and the scenes that we see him doing that in the colleges from Under Milkwood, especially, I mean, they're beautiful line readings, not quite as good as the ones I gave as a narrator in the summer camp production.
That's a high bar to cross, though.
That's a high bar, I know. Yeah. So, you know, as a character study of a character in torment, you know, in the abyss, it is fascinating, but also, you know, somewhat repetitive and one note. He's very full of himself, the character Dylan Thomas in the film, which, you know, is justified in some sense, but in another sense, it's like, you know, come off it. Malkovich has a sort of strange role as the physician who keeps telling him to stop drinking or he'll die. Tony Hale's a wonderful actor, is John Malcolm Brennan, who was a real character and ultimately wrote a book about his last days shepherding Thomas around. It's a mixed bag. Some of it is in black and white. There are some, you know, color sequences as well. I think you have to sort of really be into Dylan Thomas and Into the Abyss to really get much out of this, because it is rather a sloggy, repetitive experience.
Last call, Claudia.
Yeah, definitely sloggy and repetitive. This film has been kind of kicking around for a while. It was made in 2016. It was originally titled Dominion. Apparently the screenwriter Stephen Bernstein wrote it while staying in the same Chelsea hotel where Dylan Thomas famously came into the lobby and announced that he just had 18 straight whiskeys. That's been questioned, but I felt it was so talky and tedious, the drunken posturing, the besotted rantings, those get old very quickly. And then the flashing forward and back, it was a little more obfuscating than illuminating.
Last Call, the biographical drama written and directed by Stephen Bernstein. You can see it at the Lot, Fashion Island, Newport Beach, and the Metropolitan Fiesta Theater in Santa Barbara. It's unrated. Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square is, as you would expect, a musical. It's directed by Debbie Allen. Maria S. Schlatter is the screenwriter. It stars Christine Baranski, Jennifer Lewis, and Dolly Parton. Amy.
This is Netflix's version of community theater, which I don't really mind. You know, it's a very casual film about Dolly Parton as this angel, kind of in this bathed in this ultra angelic ring light, dressed in gray rags like an urchin from 1910, being the first homeless person who's lived in this like small town around the square where all of the action takes place. The entire town has been sold to a conglomerate by Christine Baranski to become a mall. And she's the kind of cartoonishly evil person who's, you know, handing eviction notices to children. There's a minister and a wife who form a resistance against her, and they sing about their hopes for the town, and they sing about their hopes for their fertility treatments. It's the kind of just like cornball, honestly, a little bit charming musical where everybody says exactly what they think and everybody knows exactly what kind of movie they're in. And everybody knows that this is pretty ridiculous. And there's a child bartender played by a really charming kid named Stella Kimbrough Jones, who pours whiskey to like get Christine Baranski to talk about her emotions. I mean, I feel ashamed saying that I wound up enjoying this after groaning through the first half hour.
Oh, Dolly Parton's in it. How could it not be charming?
And it's an excellent week for Dolly Parton to play an angel. You know, as we all know that she helped fund some of the research that it looks like it might work into a successful COVID vaccination. It is faintly Christian, but I will say that the film mostly worships Dolly Parton above all.
Dolly,
and that the worship of Dolly does cross the aisle.
Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square, unrated Netflix musical, starring Christine Baranski, Jennifer Lewis, and Miss Parton herself. We have much more to talk about with our critics. We'll be back in a moment. We just heard Amy Nicholson talk about Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square, new Netflix musical. A little bit later, we're going to talk about our critics' picks for holiday favorites that are available to stream. That's coming up on Film Week. We have a couple more theatrical or streaming new films to talk about, including Saul and Ruby's Holocaust Survivor Band, a documentary directed by Todd Lending, which follows Saul Dreyer and Ruby Sosnowich on their musical journey. Peter, please tell us about Saul and Ruby's Holocaust Survivor Band.
Yeah, well, Saul and Ruby both, you know, grew up in Poland as young boys, and then were faced with the Holocaust. Saul, I believe, was hit out in the woods, and Ruby was in concentration camps. They ultimately both moved to America. They married, retired to South Florida, and decided to start a klezmer band, to remind them of their past, and also as a sort of pickup for the future, something fun to do. And so they did this, and their goal was to bring the band ultimately back to Poland, where they hadn't visited in many, many, many years. So that's the framework for the movie. The band itself and the music part of it is almost peripheral to just our learning about these two wonderful gentlemen, both of whose wives, you know, were extremely ill during the making of the film. What always amazes me about these films with Holocaust survivors is how often you see this incredible indomitable spirit, despite, you know, the incredible horrors that they lived through. When they do go back to Poland, I believe it was Saul goes to Warsaw, where he grew up, and recognizes almost nothing because the city had been completely leveled during the war. And so he's trying to go back to his old haunts and doesn't really recognize everything. Whereas Ruby, I believe, goes to Krakow, another Polish town, and finds the apartment where he grew up with his family, and he's all excited. But then he goes into the vestibule and he starts to go up the stairs to where the apartment is, and suddenly he just cannot do it. He breaks down and he doesn't do it, and it's an incredibly powerful moment.
Mm. I can only imagine. Saul and Ruby's Holocaust Survivor Band, the documentary directed by Todd Lending. It's unrated, and it starts streaming next week on Fandango Now and Google Play on their on-demand platforms. The documentary Belushi brings together Jim Belushi, Chevy Chase, and Dan Aykroyd, along with others, to talk about the late John Belushi. The film is directed by R.J. Cutler. Claudia?
Yeah, this is a very detailed, intimate, and adoring movie, and it has a style that's a little unusual in that we're hearing the interviews that have been done over the course of years with Belushi's widow and some of the people who have now passed on, like Carrie Fisher and Harold Ramis, and we're seeing other visuals. We're seeing sort of archival footage as we hear that. And I don't know, I felt like a context was maybe missing here. We get the personal examination. We know he had an emotionally absent father and he lived with a lot of self-doubt. He had an addictive personality. And of course we know what that led to. And it's, you know, we see examples of his talent, but I feel like a larger context maybe in the scheme of things would have been useful here. Maybe I just feel like it's not the documentary, the ultimate documentary of John Belushi that we still need to see.
Peter, you have a quick thought on Belushi?
It's fascinating to sort of, you know, hear from the various people involved about what they observed of Belushi's decline, but it ultimately doesn't really get you inside of what was, you know, his demons, and there's so much to do with his drug usage and all that, you know, I sort of tuned out after a while. I was grateful for some of the clips from, you know, National Lampoon and you know, other films that he was in. But I do think that as a character study, it really didn't quite fill out.
Amy, quick thought on Belushi, the documentary.
Yeah, the love is definitely there, and you want to love the love, especially, like, I really appreciated hearing from Belushi's wife, who they started dating in high school, but it glosses over when Jane Curtin tries to say, here's how awful he really could have been on the Saturday Night Live set. There's some anecdotes I like, that he would use his fame to walk inside people's houses and make a sandwich, just strangers, and say, I'm Belushi, it's okay. Yeah, but when it turns into an addiction story, the thing, it isn't that interesting. You know, I like appreciating how loved he was, but I don't feel like I knew him any better myself.
It's a Showtime documentary, Belushi, directed by R.J. Cutler, and it's unrated. I want to hear from our critics, their picks for holiday streaming recommendations. Peter, what have you got that you think people should check out?
Well, I don't know how original my ideas are, but It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
But also Bad Santa.
I love that.
Which is, you know, just a great movie. Shop Around the Corner is just one of my favorite films ever. The Lubitsch film with Margaret Sullivan and Jimmy Stewart, you know, I think is one of the great all-time holiday films. Both the Gillian Armstrong and the Greta Gerwig Little Women, I think, are certainly, you know, eminently viewable.
Meet Me in St. Louis, I know you were also going to mention, which classic musical.
Great one.
Yeah. All right. Amy, what's your recommendation for the holiday?
Well, I want to say what I'm going to be having on during Thanksgiving, which is that Criterion has a couple concert documentaries that are just the perfect thing to like have in the background, to enjoy, to hang out, to like cook to, and feel like is just, it puts me in a festive mood. I don't really need to talk that much, I think, about D.A. Pennebaker's Monterey Pop concert doc from 1967, because everybody knows that that's legendary. You know, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Otis Redding. But I wanted to give a special shout out to the Total Balalaika show, which is also on Criterion, which is just like the definition of festive. The Total Balalaika show, it's a concert doc from 1993, which is 2 years after the end of the Cold War. And the Finnish director that I think a lot of people listen to that really appreciate, Aki Kaurismäki, he filmed a concert there that was a 70,000 person concert for this joint show between the Red Army Choir and the Leningrad Cowboys. And the Red Army Choir, they're this like massive all-male Russian military choir that goes back to the 20s. You know, they toured for Stalin, but by this point in their history, they were more of an anti-war group. You know, they sang at the Berlin Wall with Roger Waters, you know, where they sang songs about the wall. And the Leningrad Cowboys, of course, like that big hair comedy rock and roll band, you know, that Aki Kaurismäki actually made up to make fun of the collapsing Soviet Union. And so together, they just have this like delightful concert that's like folk songs and made up folk songs and covers of Tom Jones's Delilah and the Turtles So Happy Together and some Skinnerd. It's fun, but it also, to me, like rewatching it again lately, I was thinking how much it reminds you of like the optimism that we can get through any sort of rough time if you have a sense of humor, you know, and if you love culture together.
The Total Balalaika show streaming on Criterion. And Claudia, you got about a minute's worth of your picks?
Well, also, Meet Me in St. Louis, I have a very personal connection, which I think I might have spoken about before. Your mother.
Loved
the voice of Judy Garland, into Spanish. And so that I will always watch it with my daughters for Christmas. It's just something that, you know, has, as much as I love the movie and love the music, I also have this connection to my mother who's passed away. So that that's very powerful. And I also really love Joyeux Noël, the movie that was set during World War I, in which there was a truce for Christmas, but it also, you know, tells the story, the poignancy of the warriors who are, you know, trying to hold on to some sense of, you know, Yuletide something, you know, charity or something, but they also have to return to battle, and it doesn't really change the course of the war, and yet it's this extraordinary moment in history too. So it's a French film by Christian Carillon.
Joyeux Noël is on Amazon Prime Video, Vudu, and Google Play. Those are some of our critics' picks for the holidays. Coming up, we'll remember Indian actor Sumitra Chatterjee, who died at the age of 85, and Peter will talk with us about his acting legacy. We'll also talk about a wonderfully self-reflective piece that Peter has written for Alta Online. That coming up on Film Week.
Harole is your connection to Los Angeles. Get to know its history.
The 1920s were a huge boom time in Los Angeles, and downtown was just exploding.
It's politics.
It's the biggest local prosecutor's office in the country.
And it's food.
Korean spices with like a hint of sweetness.
And just everything we love about LA. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
Remind you, you can listen to Film Week, of course, every Friday and Saturday on KPCC, but it's also available at your convenience as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Joined this week by critics Peter Rayner, Amy Nicholson, and Claudia Puig. Peter's with us for the final segment. First, we want to pay notice to Sumitra Chatterjee, legend of Indian cinema, who succumbed to COVID-19 at the age of 85. Chatterjee, with an incredible filmography of more than 200 films. Peter, tell us about the range of his performances.
Yeah, he was one of the great actors, and he made 14 movies with Satyajit Ray, who was one of the world's greatest directors. Many of the films he made that he did not do with Ray are still unavailable in this country. But the films that he did for Ray especially are absolutely incredible. Distant Thunder, Devi. The first film he ever made as an actor was the third in the Opu trilogy, The World of Opu, which is probably the greatest film depiction of a marriage I've ever seen. Days and Nights in the Forest is a masterpiece. He played opposite Sharmila Tagore, another great actress that he played opposite with. He was his wife in World of Opu, and in Devi, an incredible movie he played towards the end of Ray's life, a film of Enemy of the People, an adaptation of Ibsen. He was one of these actors who didn't show you the acting, and so the collaborations that he had with Ray,
yeah,
are really right up there with, you know, the great collaborations in film history with, you know, Mifune and Kurosawa, Mastroianni and Fellini, Von Sydow and Bergman and Troell, Bogart and Huston, De Niro and Scorsese. You know, I mean, they were such an incredible team, and he had such a range of subtlety and nuance in his performances that, he really was one of the great actors, and his collaboration with Ray, I think, is right up there with the best work that's ever been done.
He's talking about Soumitra Chatterjee, who died at the age of 85, more than 200 films to his credit, in which he acted. Peter, you wrote a piece, A Film Critic Takes Direction, for Alta Online. We have a link to it on our Film Week page, in which you shared some things I didn't even know about you, having known you for decades now as a critic on Film Week, and before that, reading your film criticism in the Herald Examiner and Los Angeles Times. But I love how personal this piece is, talking about your childhood and the power of films, and how much your parents supported you in that, even taking you to Judith Crist, the terrific Critics Film Festival, not far from where you lived.
Yeah, I writing this piece for Alta magazine, I was really, you know, it sort of brought me back to rediscover a lot of the feelings that I had, and why I loved film so much growing up. I grew up in New York and in the suburbs, and I was able to see a lot of great movies in the revival houses and occasionally on TV. That was how you saw these films in those days. And it's always a movie for many of us, you know, including non-critics, that sort of really opened our eyes and changed our lives and, you know, said, this is what movies can be. This is something that's going to stay with me. And for me, that movie was McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And so when Judith Crist had this weekend where she showed a lot of Raymond Chandler movies like Big Sleep and many others that are less well known, Robert Altman was the guest, and The Long Goodbye was about to come out, and they had a preview of it for the paying guests, and I was still in college, but you know, my parents funded me the weekend, and I was so nervous. You know, I revered Altman, but I hardly said anything to him, except at the very end I just went over and sort of blurted out how much I loved this movie. Mm-hmm. You know, and then when I was in college, I wrote reviews almost every week for my college newspaper, and this all led to my, you know, being a film critic, and I think the piece is also about, you know, what happens if you, you know, if you really love a movie and a filmmaker and you're in a position such as I am to cross paths with these people, you know, and how do you deal with that as a critic? You know, I mean, there are all sorts of red flags and white flags, and so I did, you know, meet up with Altman over the years, and it was an interesting experience, you know, because he was very good at manipulating critics, and at the same time, he had this incredible body of work, and critics don't often talk about this, but I think, you know, if you really love a film artist and you have the opportunity to have some connection to them, I mean, obviously you have to be very careful. But it's only a human response, I think, to want to reach out in some way. And often, you know, you're disappointed with the person as opposed to the artist. But that's natural and normal and to be expected. What ultimately matters is the work itself. And so it was sort of a journey for me in writing the piece to come to terms with a lot of those feelings that I had.
You know, I think for myself, you know, like everybody else, so admiring the work of John Ford or Alfred Hitchcock and you know, what would I have wanted to meet them? And you, because you know, so often with film directors, their reputations are of being difficult and control freaks, and you know, particularly some of the greats have personal characteristics which make them legendarily difficult. And do you think that you know, what for your experience, did it affect how you watched Altman's film, that you got to know him a bit?
I tried very hard to separate it out, and it's not like we were buddies, you know, this isn't Tuesdays with Bob piece. But I think, you know, I've met enough filmmakers, enough actors, enough directors, enough writers that I, you know, greatly admire to sort of be able to separate out, you know, who they are from what they do. And I've almost never learned much about a particular filmmaker from meeting the filmmaker. I mean, often there's a real disconnect between who they are and what they make. And that was true of Altman, too. I mean, Altman was, you know, was a very expansive but crafty guy who could be, you know, quite peremptory with people, and, you know, much more so than he ever was with me. But he took issue with a lot of the stuff that I did as well. There was a time when I, you know, panned a lot of his movies. And he, you know, wrote, he took me to task for it in an interview that he gave for a magazine. And, you know, I mean, that's fine. But it's still fascinating to me to meet these characters, I should say, quote unquote. I mentioned in the piece having met David Lean when he was promoting the revamp of Lawrence of Arabia in the late 80s in his suite at the Bel Air Hotel. And we're talking about his films, and suddenly he sort of, you know, jumps up on the couch. It's almost like I'm not there, and he's describing for me in saddening shot-by-shot detail a scene from his aborted Mutiny on the Bounty picture that Dino De Laurentiis killed. You know, it was an amazing, startling experience. You know,
bad.
That in the pieces, he's sort of like mad royalty all of a sudden.
And it begins with the more recent episode of Quentin Tarantino accepting his Best Screenplay Award for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with the New York Film Critics, and specifically mentioning how difficult it was to have the critic he loved from reading your work in the Herald Examiner pan some of his films. So, Peter, it's a wonderful piece. It's up on our Film Week page on Alta Online. A film critic takes direction from our own Peter Rayner. Peter, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry.
Christian Science Monitor film critic Peter Rayner has been film critic with us on Film Week for decades. Film Week comes your way every Friday and Saturday on KPCC, but is available whenever you want to hear it, on your smart speaker and the podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great weekend.